Good evening. Trump floats Pelosi as a caretaker president. DeJoy says no to bringing back postal machines. Biden accepts Bannon's fake wall, and a judge allows the release of hundreds of thousands of NYPD complaint records. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Friday, August 21st, 2020. Donald Trump warned a conservative gathering that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi could become president if mail-in voting delays election results. The Constitution says presidential terms end January 20th if the November 3rd election is still unresolved. Succession is a matter of debate. Would Democrat Pelosi become acting president, or as some conservatives maintain, would Secretary of State Mike Pompeo become the acting president?
I really don't think that you're going to know anything on the evening, anything meaningful or anything real, on the evening of November 3rd. I don't think you're going to know anything. You're not going to know what happened. I don't think you'll know 2 weeks later. I don't think you'll know 4 weeks later. And I don't know what's going to happen. You know, there's a theory that if you don't have it by the end of the year, crazy Nancy Pelosi would become president. You know that, right? No, no, think of that. Think of that. There's that mad theory, too. You have heard that theory. Now, I don't know if it's a theory or a fact, but I said, that's not good. That's not good. No, no, there is a theory that if you don't have it, and that's part of their whole act, that if you don't have a choice, that the Speaker of the House becomes president. And that, I think, goes into effect either on the 20th or the 1st. And put that in the hopper. Add that to everything else. It's a disgrace.
Trump spoke as Postmaster General Louis DeJoy pledged at a Senate committee hearing to speed the delivery of election mail. DeJoy denied Democratic claims he's purposely undermining mail-in voting. But DeJoy also says he has no intention of returning dozens of barcode-reading postal machines that he's taken out of service.
There's no intention to do that. They're not needed, sir.
So you will not bring back any processors?
They're not needed, sir.
According to a Postal Workers Union spokesperson, the missing machines means 4.5 million pieces of mail a week will not be processed. Lisa Graves is executive director of True North Research, an organization conducting investigative reports into threats to American democracy.
From the standpoint of DeJoy's testimony, basically he refused expressly to return those mail sorting machines that have been removed and disabled. And there was a directive by someone who reports to him for those machines not to be replugged in, the ones that are still operational. And he said he was not going to reverse course on that, which was pretty outrageous, given the fact, as you point out, Paul, that that is part of the reason why there's been this surge in mail not being delivered on time suddenly since DeJoy took over. The other part of his statement that was also troubling was this notion that by his edict that the mail trucks leave, quote, on time, even if they're leaving mail behind, that supposedly was going to make delivery better for people, when obviously it was going to cause mail to accumulate. And if he's the logistics expert he pulled himself out to be, that would be an obvious effect. And so what you're seeing around the country is chaos. There's reports in different parts of the country about dead animals, chicks that were ordered by farmers. There's reports about other medicines in numerous states across the country where people have not received their medicines on time, life-saving, necessary medicines. And so what was astounding was to see some of these Republican senators, including Ron Johnson, the chairman of that committee, assert that this was just some sort of Democratic plot to claim that there were problems with the post office and that, in fact, everything is fine and is operating as it should be, when it's obviously not fine and it's obviously not operating as it should be with DeJoy's activities at the helm.
Is this a libertarian thing to get rid of the post office, or is this Trump?
There certainly is a long-term strategy by Charles Koch, a long-term goal of privatizing the Postal Service that Rand Paul, in his own way, articulated as a person who adopts these libertarian theories. Donald Trump's budget from 2018 also pushed for privatization, and you can read descriptions of Steve Mnuchin, who's the Treasury Secretary, his efforts to constrain the Postal Service as another step toward privatization. So this is part of what we see underway and that DeJoy is attempting to carry out, is these sorts of measures that will lend the post office toward this privatization goal or move it toward that goal. it's also the case that you have a post office that's the most politicized in its history. With DeJoy, you have someone who's been close to President Trump, who was chosen along with Michael Cohen to be one of his deputy finance chairmen for the RNC, someone who's held fundraisers in his home for Donald Trump, raised millions for him. That's who DeJoy is. He's a partisan money man who has instrumentally aided Donald Trump in his political ambitions. And the chairman of the board of the governors for the Postal Service is also a money man, a man who helped raise money for Mitch McConnell to retain control of the United States Senate, and who also worked for a time with Karl Rove on his American Crossroads operation. So you literally have two of the most partisan men ever in modern history at the helm of the Postal Service at a time when it is poised to play this crucial role in our elections. And I think that's very troubling. It should trouble anyone who cares about having an independent agency that's devoted to the good of all Americans and not aiding a political agenda, including Charles Koch's agenda that Donald Trump has embraced, which is toward privatizing our postal service.
What should we do about this?
It's vitally important that people call their senators, call your representatives, and demand that they save the postal service. I think Louis DeJoy needs to be removed from that post. I don't trust this postal board. I think we need reform that starts over with a new postal board that is not politicized in this way, and a postal service that's not led by two extreme partisans. We deserve better. We deserve a postal service that's led by people devoted to expanding it as a great public service versus cutting it back and following a corporate strategy, which ultimately would corporatize this vital public service.
Lisa Graves is executive director of True North Research. DeJoy promised this week to postpone any further changes until after the election, saying he wanted to avoid even the perception of interference with the election. And Steve Bannon on Friday vowed to fight on after being arrested for allegedly diverting money meant for a privately funded border wall for personal expenses, labeling his indictment a political hit job.
I am not going to back down. This is a political hit job. Everybody knows I love a fight. You know, I was called Honey Badger for many years. You know, Honey Badger doesn't give. So, you know, I'm in this for the long haul. I'm in this for the fight. I'm going to continue to fight. This was to stop and intimidate people that want to talk about the wall. This is to stop and intimidate people that have President Trump's back on building the wall.
And Steve Bannon, he was a Wall Street trader turned filmmaker, producing documentaries attacking Hillary Clinton. He was a key advisor to Trump in 2016, who left the White House after conflicts with Ivanka and Jared Kushner. He picked up the name Honey Badger as an editor for Breitbart, a conservative website. The indictment against Bannon and three others, including a triple amputee veteran, Brian Kofage, says the group conspired to cover up their intent to pocket monies they said would go to build a section of border wall along the lower Rio Grande River in Texas on privately owned land. Local border activists say from the beginning they suspected the wall was a scam. Vicki Galbecka is executive director of the Southern Border Community Coalition.
Even before Trump was elected, we knew that we experienced the reality of a border wall and what that meant to our environment, our wildlife, and to people in general. Many of the walls that were built before Trump was elected actually forced people to migrate in more remote regions of the border, exposing them to injury, and many have died. Over 8,000 people have died in the desert or in the Rio Grande Valley as a result of the walls that were built through urban sectors. And now under the Trump administration, we're just seeing basically the fulfillment of an ill-informed campaign prop. And they're just sort of ramping up the speed in which they're building this border wall here. And it's not only putting the lives of our community members and migrants at risk, it's also putting the life of endangered species at risk. And then come along this group of people who may be angered because Congress refused to fund at the level that Trump wanted. They decided to take matters into their own hand, and they built two sections of the wall, one in El Paso, Texas, and another one in the lower Rio Grande Valley in Texas. And even right as soon as they built that wall, the one in the lower Rio Grande Valley, we all laughed because they built it right up next to the edge of the Rio Grande. And anybody who knows anything about the Rio Grande River here in the border region, we knew that Mother Nature would take care of that section of the wall. And in fact, that section of wall in question is right now experiencing erosion because of all the rains and that region has had recently. So it'll be only a matter of time before that private wall that was built by We Build the Wall will be falling into the river. And then to find out that actually Steve Bannon and his colleagues, if you will, were fundraising and claimed that all the money was going to go to a border wall, and to find out that they were actually using that money fraudulently, it really didn't surprise us, but it just speaks to the moral character of some of the people who work for the Trump administration.
There's groups that are going out there and trying to help people who are crossing the desert and leaving water for them, and they've come under attack by the Border Patrol, who say it's a felony or wrong to have any sort of empathy for these folks. Do you work with those groups at all?
The group that you're talking about is No More Debt. And there are other groups along the border, too, that go out into the desert and to the remote regions of the border to provide humanitarian assistance, which, by the way, wouldn't be necessary if it hadn't been for these deterrent, prevention through deterrence tactics of the government. Many of them are doctors, nurses, public health specialists who volunteer their time to go out and provide medical assistance to individuals, life-saving medical assistance to these individuals.
Prevention through deterrence means creating conditions that are so horrifying, such as sharpening the stakes on the fence and things like that, which I've been reading about, that it actually causes physical harm to people.
Exactly.
Taking away children, like Trump said he wanted to do, on purpose to deter them.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly right. All those horrible policies, cruel and horrible policies that we've seen out of this administration are basically tactics that they think that level of horribleness and cruelty will actually deter people from coming.
Does it?
No. No, it doesn't, because they're escaping from equally harsh conditions sometimes. Or they're just trying to reunite with loved ones who are in this country. Love is a strong motivator and the desire to improve your life circumstances is also a strong motivator. And I think that instead of treating individuals with such courage and strength in such a terrible way, really we should be ashamed of ourselves and start rethinking what is the character of the people we want in this country. Certainly, immigrants have contributed a great amount to this nation, and so we just need to reevaluate that.
All right. Anything you'd like to add?
It would be really great if people understood what border communities were about. We're a place of encounter, of hope, of opportunity, and we're tired of being mischaracterized, and we just want to make sure that our constitutional rights are protected here, just like everyone else in this country. So we hope that people come and visit with that perspective instead of building a ridiculously wasteful and lethal wall.
Vicki Galbeka is Executive Director of the Southern Border Community Coalition. Steve Bannon faces up to 20 years in federal prison. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. And last night was the final act of the mostly online Democratic National Convention that was supposed to have been held in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, echoing Trump's Vice President Mike Pence, media comedian and actress Julia Louis-Dreyfus bantered with former candidate Andrew Yang, mimicking Pence's purposeful mispronunciation of Democratic Veep nominee Kamala Harris's name.
Between the two of us, we have 11 Emmys. How's that for math? One of my favorite actresses, Julia Louis-Dreyfus. Hey, Julia.
Hi, Andrew. It's so glad to see you. So what did you think about Kamala Harris's speech last night?
It was tremendous. I was so happy for her.
I know. Me too. She was fabulous. I cannot wait to see her debate our current vice president, Mika Pence. Or is it Pence?
It's pronounced Ponce, I believe.
Oh, some kind of weird foreign name?
Yeah, not very American sounding.
Yeah, that's what people are saying strongly.
Dreyfus was the star of a television program about a female vice president titled Veep. A touching moment in the convention came as an 11-year-old kid, Braden Harrington, who stuttered, spoke about meeting Joe Biden, himself someone who stuttered as a child.
Hi, my name is Braden Harrington, and I'm 13 years old. And without Joe Biden, I wouldn't be talking to you today. About a few months ago, I met him in New Hampshire. He told me that we were members of the same club. We stutter. It was really amazing to hear that someone like me became vice president. He told me about a book of poems by Yeats he would read out loud to practice. He showed me how he marks his addresses to make them easier to say out loud. So I did the same thing today. And now I'm here talking to you today about the future.
And that's Braden Harrington. The scene echoed a much different and sinister encounter in 2016 when candidate Trump mocked disabled New York Times reporter Serge Kovaleski, imitating his voice and mannerisms as Trump's fans laughed.
Written by a nice reporter. Now the poor guy, you got to see this guy. Oh, I don't know what I said. I don't remember. He's going like, I don't remember. Maybe that's what I said.
And that was President Trump in 2016. The high point last evening was Joe Biden's acceptance speech, marked by poetry and references to philosophy.
It's time for us, for we the people, to come together. And make no mistake, united we can and will overcome this season of darkness in America. We'll choose hope over fear, facts over fiction, fairness over privilege. Now, nearly a century ago, Franklin Roosevelt pledged the New Deal in a time of massive unemployment, uncertainty, and fear. Stricken by a disease, stricken by a virus, FDR insisted that he would recover and prevail, and he believed America could as well. And he did, and we can as well. And the president keeps telling us the virus is going to disappear. He keeps waiting for a miracle. Well, I have news for him. No miracle is coming. We lead the world in confirmed cases. We lead the world in deaths. Our economy is in tatters with Black, Latino, Asian American, Native American communities bearing the brunt of it. And after all this time, the president still does not have a plan. Well, I do. We'll make sure our schools have the resources they need to be open, safe, and effective. We'll put politics aside. We'll take the muzzle off our experts so the public gets the information they need and deserve. Under President Biden, America will not turn a blind eye to Russian bounties on the heads of American soldiers, nor will I put up with foreign interference in our most sacred democratic exercise, voting. And I'll always stand for our values of human rights and dignity. I'll work in common purpose for a more secure, peaceful, and prosperous world. I believe we're ready. Just a week ago yesterday was the third anniversary of the events in Charlottesville. Close your eyes. Remember what you saw on television. Remember seeing those neo-Nazis and Klansmen and white supremacists coming out of fields with lighted torches, veins bulging, spewing the same anti-Semitic bile heard across Europe in the 30s. Remember the violent clash that ensued between those spreading hate and those with the courage to stand against it. And remember what the president said when asked? He said there were, quote, very fine people on both sides. It was a wake-up call for us as a country, and for me, a call to action. At that moment, I knew I'd have to run, because my father taught us that silence was complicity. The Irish poet Seamus Heaney once wrote, "History says, don't hope on this side of the grave. But then, once in a lifetime, the longed-for tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. This is our moment to make hope and history rhyme. with passion and purpose. Let us begin, you and I together, one nation, under God, united in our love for America, united in our love for each other. For love is more powerful than hate. Hope is more powerful than fear. And light is more powerful than dark. This is our moment. This is our mission. May history be able to say that the end of this chapter of American darkness began here tonight.
Vice President Joe Biden. In local news, yesterday, the Second Circuit Court lifted the stay preventing the New York Civil Liberties Union from publishing its database of NYPD officer misconduct records that it obtained from the New York City Civilian Complaint Review Board, or CCRB, the independent agency that investigates certain complaints about police abuse of civilians. In June 2020, the state legislature voted to repeal Section 50A of the Civil Rights Law, the decades-old statute that police departments use to hide police misconduct and discipline information from the public. According to the New York Civil Liberties Union, about 81,000 different officers had 8,700 complaints that led to an NYPD penalty. 20,000 officers were named in five or more complaints. However, activists say only 12 officers were terminated or dismissed by the NYPD. 20,000 of the complaints were substantiated by the CCRB. Molly Bicklin is a deputy legal director of the New York Civil Liberties Union.
The district court initially enjoined the NYCLU from releasing these documents. And then after briefing and a hearing on this issue, she reversed. But she gave the police unions 24 hours to appeal to the Second Circuit, which they did. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals then imposed an administrative stay while it heard the issue. And on Tuesday, it heard argument on this issue after briefing from the parties, the NYCLU, the New York Times, and others. Yesterday, it lifted the stay with an opinion to follow. Immediately, the NYCLU was allowed to publish this database. And that's what we did.
What is in the database?
It's really sort of the history or the lack of history of NYPD discipline of its own. What we see is that this process, this accountability process, has been shrouded in secrecy. These records have not been made known. The NYPD does not police itself. Of these over 300,000 complaints, very few officers, or those few complaints have actually resulted in officer discipline. And just 12 officers have been terminated or demoted as a result of these complaints. And so what I think it gives us an opportunity is to see the lack of accountability for our police department. And I think this is the beginning of hopefully change that we will see to introduce more accountability and transparency into this process.
A lot of these cases, you said 3% were substantiated. So a lot of these cases were unsubstantiated.
The 3% number is that have led to a NYPD penalty. So that's not the number that have been substantiated. Many more cases are substantiated. Over 20,000 cases have been substantiated by the CCRB. What we see from this discrepancy between the number of complaints and the number of substantiations, looking at this database, you also see investigations that are truncated, investigations where there's not cooperation from the NYPD to actually investigate, where they're not able to have the full resources, is that this process is really failing New Yorkers in terms of accountability.
What do you hope this would lead to as far as accountability?
Well, I think this is the beginning of a process that now that these records are made public and through the implementation of the repeal of Civil Rights Law 50A, which imposed great secrecy on any kind of police misconduct or accountability, that the public will be able to have a conversation about holding the police, who hold great power over the public, accountable for actions and to be really responsive, actually, to the community.
Would Officer Pantaleo would we have found out something, or would there have been a signal sent that there was a problem with this officer if these files had been available 5 years ago?
What you'd have seen is that he had 7 misconduct cases investigated during the 5 years before Eric Garner's death. And that certainly is related.
And we'll be looking at some of these other officers who were involved in these high-profile cases and finding out what was going on in their histories that we didn't know, I guess, in the days and weeks to come.
I think this will be a whole new insight into the NYPD and how it enforces its own rules, how it responds to public complaints and officer accountability, and is really important for the residents of New York.
And that's Molly Bicklin. She is the deputy legal director of the New York Civil Liberties Union. And that's some of the news for Friday, August 21st, 2020. The news is produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson from New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo for the WBAI News. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.